This is The Takeaway for Monday, December 18, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Just 1 week to go till Christmas, and in Congress, they're trying to make Christmas come early this year. The Senate is set to vote this week on the final version of the tax cut bill. Final deals are being struck. Meanwhile, all the good girls and boys in Congress are still unwrapping this giant gift, even as they get ready to vote. What's in it? And hang on, who's this $1.4 trillion gift actually for?
This is going to be one of the great gifts to the middle-income people of this country that they've ever gotten for Christmas.
President Trump says that giant present under the tree with an unrecognizable shape, it's for you, the middle class. Is it? Because here's young Senator Bobby Corker bounding down the stairs early on Christmas morning. He didn't think the tax bill was for him. Oh, no. But wait, the tag says to Bobby, "Hope your pass-through business does great this year," from Santa. Huh? Sure, Bobby Corker has made millions on pass-through businesses, but he wasn't expecting a gift from Santa this year. You see, pass-throughs are companies organized so that they don't have to pay corporate income tax. Instead, income passes through to the owner to be taxed under the individual tax rate. And in this bill, pass-throughs get a big, fat, new tax cut. Now, lots of boys and girls use pass-throughs, the corner store owner, the plumber, but also big boys and girls like Renaissance Technologies, a hedge fund worth $65 billion, or even the Trump Organization itself. It's a Christmas miracle. Martin Sullivan is the chief economist and contributing editor for Tax Analysts. Martin, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Todd.
So what's the big change here that Congress has made in its final negotiations for pass-throughs? Why is this making news?
Well, first of all, there's a whole question about why there's any special relief for pass-throughs at all, since they pay lower taxes than other businesses. So that's the first thing you have to ask yourself. And then the second thing is that they've added these very complicated rules, which is just the opposite of what you want to do for small businesses. You want to make their tax filing easier. But what's happened in the final hours of the bill is that they've adjusted these very technical rules. And what has gotten a lot of attention is that the way they've done these adjustments is that it helps real estate investors in particular. And so on the list of prominent real estate investors are Senator Corker. They're calling it the Corker kickback. And also the President of the United States, Mr. Trump.
Now, you mentioned Senator Corker. That's Bob Corker of Tennessee, who was threatening to vote no on this tax bill, changed his vote to yes after this change was made. Now, Bob Corker says he wasn't aware of the change. And in fact, over the weekend, he's written a letter to the chairman of the Finance Committee, Orrin Hatch, demanding an explanation. This all sounds a little strange.
Well, I used to work on Capitol Hill, and it doesn't surprise me at all that a senator doesn't know what's in the bill that he's voting on. So at least give him the benefit of the doubt on that, although I have no hard information. But I think it's an absurd situation when a senator is trying to prove to the public that he did not know what was in the bill.
After switching his vote from no to yes, and a change was made that would benefit him directly.
Absolutely. I mean, he's a very I think he's the fourth wealthiest member of the Senate, and he used to be in construction, but he got into the real estate business and did quite well. And so this would reduce his effective tax rate from something like 40% to 30%. And when you have many hundreds of millions of dollars of real estate, that really adds up.
President Trump is fond of saying that this tax bill would hit him hard. Basically, he's championing tax changes that are bad for him, but better for most Americans. Knowing what we know about pass-throughs and the president's use of them, is that true?
Well, of course, I haven't seen his tax return, so it's very hard to know. But
right.
Taking an educated guess, he and his children will benefit from the state tax relief. He'll benefit from the lower tax rate from 39.6% to 37%. But this so-called Corker kickback, there are only certain industries that qualify for this benefit. And before the conference committee, before the very last minute changes that were made, real estate investors were not going to be eligible for it. And by reason of this last minute change, real estate investors do qualify for the change. And since Trump has extensive real estate ownings in the pass-through form, he would be a significant beneficiary.
Martin, so there are these special provisions that may benefit Bob Corker and the president and their political allies. But pass-throughs more generally got some really favorable treatment in the earlier stages of negotiation here. What's the benefit? What's the impact of doing this? Is there evidence that a break for pass-throughs would be good for the economy, more investment, more jobs, or just good for the people who own them?
Well, anytime you have a tax cut that creates favorable business conditions, and you do expect some uptick in their hiring. However, if you had to provide, and this is what I used to do when I worked on Capitol Hill, we would design tax incentives to increase employment. This would probably be the last way we would do it, A, because of its complexity, B, because it picks winners and losers, and C, because it's not particularly targeted to increasing employment. For example, if you wanted to increase employment, you would provide perhaps a tax credit for hiring, do it directly. And that is not part of this bill at all.
Well, Bob Corker has written to Orrin Hatch demanding an explanation for this pass-through change that's going to benefit Bob Corker. For this to pass the smell test for you, Martin Sullivan, what should that answer be? What do you want to hear?
Well, speaking not as an expert, but as a private citizen, yeah, I would like to know how this got into the bill. And I would like to know how a lot of things got into the bill. It's all been done behind closed doors. There's no transparency. And I think it's outrageous when a senator who votes on the bill doesn't even know what's in the bill. This whole episode just brings out the lack of transparency in the whole process. And it's very unfair, I think, to the American people.
Martin Sullivan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Martin Sullivan is chief economist and contributing editor for Tax Analysts. There was news from the Washington Post over the weekend. Policy analysts at the Centers for Disease Control were given a list of 7 forbidden words they should avoid when putting together their budget proposals. The words are
vulnerable,
evidence-based,
science-based,
entitlement,
fetus,
transgender,
and diversity.
Well, the list earned shock and ridicule from scientists and members of the public. CDC Chief Dr. Brenda Fitzgerald tweeted over the weekend, though, that there were no banned words. Instead, some officials are suggesting that the change in language is a technique to make it easier for Republicans to approve the budget. Michael Halperin is the deputy director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists.
The CDC is there to prevent disease outbreaks and support disaster preparedness and to promote public health. It has this strong reputation for independence and for leaders that defend that independence. So when you see them coming out with a list of banned words, I mean, the idea that we're somehow at a point where words like diversity or science-based would be controversial is just remarkable.
Well, what's going on here in your view, Michael Halperin? Is it common to de-emphasize or ban certain words like this? We've seen debates like this in the past. People might remember things like the Mexico City language, which bars entities that receive U.S. foreign aid from discussing abortion. Is this like that, just regular old politics?
It's pretty common for politicians to play to their audience and for anyone to send a message in a way that they think it's going to be received well. But when you ban certain words like science-based or evidence-based or transgender or diversity, you're getting towards a point where scientists won't be able to do their work at all. We're in a situation where if you don't do the research, if you don't collect the data on a certain population, you don't have anything to talk about or to get in the way of policies that you don't want to put forward. So earlier this year, we saw on LGBT Americans, the Census Department was reversing course and stopping a proposal to collect more information about sexual orientation, even though there were a lot of federal agencies that were pleading with them to do so. If you don't ask for the information, you don't have to address the challenges that those populations face.
Well, some of this might be plausible in the world of politics, Michael, not wanting to traffic in words like transgender or fetus. I mean, in the world of politics, you might understand why some people would want to do that. But evidence-based, science-based, are those really areas that are charged politically these days?
I don't think they should be. And, you know, word choice matters. We have to be able to talk about the populations that we need to serve. I'm thinking of Dr. Hannah Atisha, who's the Michigan doctor who is really instrumental in bringing attention to the Flint water crisis. And she said over the weekend that so much of the fight in Flint was about words, that it was really important to be able to accurately describe the threat that Flint residents were facing and who the residents were who are most likely to be exposed to unsafe levels of lead. The same situation comes true when it comes to transgender people or when it comes to any kind of group that the CDC is supposed to be able to serve.
Well, what about Brenda Fitzgerald's claim here that this is just kind of strategic censorship to avoid offending the sensibilities of conservative Republican appropriators, and that if you use the right words, they might be looser with the funding?
If we get to a point where science-based is somehow controversial or is somehow a red flag for Congress, we're not serving the public. I mean, we've seen all presidents and all administrations politicize science in some way, whether it be Obama on fracking and emergency contraception or President Bush, everything from climate change to endangered species. And so politics and science kind of go hand in hand when it comes to making policy. But we have to be honest with the American people when it comes to doing scientific research. This sends a message that scientists should be keeping their heads down. And when scientists who work for CDC or NASA or the Department of Energy fear for their jobs for sharing their expertise with the American public, we're all worse off for it.
Still, we're all used to in politics, you know, modifying language, whether you say pro-choice or pro-life. There's just one example that could make a huge difference to someone. Is this worth it if it means $500 million or $1 billion more funding for public health research?
I think this is more part of a pattern of the censorship of information. So earlier this year, you had the Health and Human Services Department rescinding $200 million in grant funding for teen pregnancy research halfway through the studies. And that meant that 2 years of research and hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars were essentially wasted. So more importantly, I think it means that we're also less prepared to continue success in reducing teen pregnancy and addressing these kinds of issues. So whether or not people choose the right words, we're seeing a pattern of political interference in science that impacts public health and safety.
So where do you think this goes, Michael Halpern? If it's the case that certain members of Congress just don't want to hear words like transgender or evidence-based and they're making decisions, what's the ultimate outcome of an attitude like that?
Well, science requires openness and honesty, not censorship and fear. And if scientists are looking over their shoulder, worried they might say the wrong word or ask the wrong question, they're not going to be pursuing the tough questions that we need to ask. They're going to be less likely to pursue the most promising lines of inquiry, and we're going to squander a lot of opportunities to improve public health and safety and protect the environment.
Michael Halpern with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
I can't imagine there's anything on them, frankly, because, as we said, there's no collusion. There's no collusion whatsoever.
FBI Special Counsel Robert Mueller has obtained thousands of emails and documents from President Trump's transition team after the 26th election and before he took office on January 20th. Of course, it's all part of the investigation into Russian interference and possible collusion in the campaign. White House lawyers, meanwhile, are challenging the legality of Mueller collecting evidence in this way, and the president has called the investigation a witch hunt. But conservative media outlets are doing something different here. A steady drumbeat at places like Fox News, consistently and relentlessly attacking Mueller and his investigation.
So the investigation into Donald Trump's campaign has been crooked from the jump.
If the fix was in, Comey should go to jail.
This is worse than even I imagined.
But we don't even know how much money Mueller has requested to spend on this witch hunt.
The investigation was weaponized to destroy his presidency for partisan political purposes.
It's time to take them out in cuffs.
Those attacks have people wondering if the White House's allies are laying the groundwork for the president to fire Robert Mueller. Nicole Hemmer is an assistant professor at the University of Virginia Miller Center and author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics.
We see hosts calling this investigation illegitimate, saying that it's a partisan witch hunt, saying that Trump should end the investigation, and seem a little curious as to why he hasn't ended it already.
So talk about the latest charge that conservative media are hammering on here. One was that there was a member of Mueller's team that was shown texting pro-Hillary stuff to a girlfriend, right? But what about this latest episode? Bob Mueller obtains tens of thousands of emails from the General Services Administration from the Trump transition team. What's wrong with that in the eyes of the critics of the investigation here?
Well, in a kind of lovely irony, calling back to the 2016 campaign, they're arguing that those emails are private and that he shouldn't have access to them, that they're protected by either executive privilege or just by privacy rights. The thing that has been so upsetting, it seems, to members of the Trump team is that they did not know that he had those emails and therefore have not aligned the stories that they have told the investigative team with what those emails may reveal. So there is a real panic happening, but the charges that he shouldn't have them in the first place.
Now, you've written about and talked about a feedback loop in conservative media. What exactly do you mean by that phenomenon? And do you see it here?
Yes. And so conservative media are very much aware that Donald Trump is pretty upset about this investigation. Trump has made very clear since it began that he felt like it was an illegitimate investigation. And places like Fox News know that Trump watches them. What they're doing is they're picking up on his dislike and disdain for this investigation, and then they're feeding into that by running segments that they know that he'll see about how the investigation is illegitimate, and that simply gives him more sort of fodder for believing that it's something that shouldn't be happening. And so I think it ups the likelihood that, despite what he said yesterday, that he would end this investigation.
You know, a lot of people have been concerned and criticized Fox News for essentially carrying the White House message too often on their broadcasts. This seems like a separate concern. This seems like the opposite, that Fox News might actually be influencing the president himself.
Even if it's not a coordinated effort, that Fox, since Trump won the nomination and then the presidency, really has shifted to become more Trumpian and to try to give the president what he wants in their messaging. And he watches it, so it gins him up as well.
What has to happen for this discontent over the investigation to get out of the Fox News world and into the rest of the media?
There would have to be some sort of really legitimate story to come out that would discredit the Mueller investigation. And just given what we know about the players involved, that seems unlikely to happen, but we'll have to wait and see.
Nicole Hemmer from the Miller Center at the University of Virginia, also author of Messengers of the Right. Professor Hemmer, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Just 2 months ago, a Bitcoin was worth $5,500. This morning, it opened at over $19,000. Overall, Bitcoin has shot up more than 1,800% since the start of the year. Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency that exists in algorithms on computer servers, but the skyrocketing price has people wondering what's going on with Bitcoin and whether it's a bubble that could burst. Isabella Kaminska is editor at the Alphaville blog at the Financial Times. Isabella, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Why has the price of Bitcoin skyrocketed so much in the last few months?
That's the $64 billion question. I think there are lots of theories out there, but predominantly it's anticipation of the listing of the futures, which just occurred last week at the CBOE and today on the CME, which is one of the world's biggest commodity exchanges. So in anticipation of this, people have been buying up Bitcoin. There's been a lot of positive PR, and that sort of positive feedback, I think, has created a sentiment in the market which has helped to bolster the price.
Why would listing of futures of Bitcoin make the price go so high?
There's a general perception that Bitcoin is quite hard to buy. It's ironic because it came to market under the premise that this was going to make banking much easier, that it was going to revolutionize payments. But the reality of it is that buying Bitcoin is really hard, especially if you're an institution or anyone who has obligations, so-called fiduciary obligations. As soon as futures are listed, this takes out a lot of counterparty risk. So it becomes a little less risky because these contracts do exchange in a regulated market. And until now, that's been lacking in Bitcoin.
Well, we've done this before, Isabella, but Bitcoin is still kind of a new concept to people used to trading in dollars or pounds sterling. Would you just take a second and remind us exactly what a Bitcoin is?
So a Bitcoin is like a virtual asset, which was created in 2009 by an anonymous creator called Satoshi Nakamoto. And the idea was very much that it would challenge the formal banking system and get rid of the conventional third-party banker and intermediary. This was a network of people mining Bitcoin, which means essentially running very complex algorithms to try and secure a network of code which created a scarce asset, which is a Bitcoin. There's only going to be 21 million of these Bitcoins, and they run in a forward-planned sort of creation mechanism. And as a result of that total predictive supply, we can kind of anticipate at any moment how many there are. They come to market roughly every 10 minutes or so, but over the course of the last few years, the rate at which they come onto the market changes. It's all predetermined in the algorithms. But in a much sort of easier and layperson-friendly perspective, Bitcoins are basically virtual assets which are self-created by a network of people who commit to dedicating a lot of computer power to supporting the network.
Now, that computer power actually, and this surprised me, has raised concerns of environmental damage. Is that just because computers have to work so very hard to network and mine these Bitcoins that you're talking about?
Well, one of the reasons Bitcoin has value is because it's so hard to mine these Bitcoins. You know, I always say Bitcoin is a luxury asset because it really does involve the purposeful wastage of energy just for the sake of creating a secure system. And yes, the energy that is being spent in mining Bitcoins is absolutely extraordinary. And the higher the price goes, the more energy that it is wasted. A lot of critics of people who say Bitcoin is energy inefficient, they will say, well, compared to the conventional banking system, the amount of energy that Bitcoin uses is non-consequential. But of course, this isn't really a fair comparative because Bitcoin's energy cost is only from the server perspective. Once you start including all the third-party organizations, because ironically, Bitcoin has turned out to be just as dependent on third parties as the conventional banking system. So in reality, you've got a situation where not only are the servers burning a lot of energy, much more so than the servers of the conventional banking system, you've got on top of that the growing footprint, the carbon footprint of all the Bitcoin billionaires, the intermediary funds, and all the associated supported infrastructure.
Huh, it's amazing. It's hard to imagine a currency that lives just on computer servers is actually an environmental problem. But here's the key question, Isabella. I mentioned some numbers at the top. Bitcoin is now worth over $19,000 per Bitcoin, a 1,700% increase since the beginning of the year. Is this a bubble? What's going to happen?
It's really hard to know because it's entirely detached from any intrinsic value. It's very hard to put a valuation on it. So yes, it does very much look like a bubble, but it might be the world's biggest bubble that ever existed. It's already surpassed historical bubbles such as the South Sea bubble and the Tulip Mania bubble. And we're looking at a situation, ironically, where it could go, there is no ceiling on Bitcoin. When you buy oil, there's always like one barrel of oil you're buying or a bushel of wheat. There is no such anchor in Bitcoin, which means theoretically, I could today offer you $100 for, you know, one tenth of a Bitcoin and the valuation would spike to unreasonable grounds.
What does that mean then, that somebody who bought a Bitcoin for $18, I don't know, 5 years ago, it's now worth $19,000. Are they truly rich?
Well, this is the thing. In finance, there's something called, you know, paper profits. And this became a thing back in the global financial crisis. And so much as everybody thought they were sitting on a lot of wealth. But in reality, the liquidity that underpins that valuation is not always there. And that's one of the reasons the crisis was triggered. With Bitcoin, it's no different. People are sitting on these huge sums of supposed wealth. But if you try to actually liquidate it, whether you can get that price is another matter. And certainly at the moment, we're seeing a lot of stories coming about where it is definitely easier to buy Bitcoin than it is to sell it.
Isabella Kaminska, editor at the Alphaville blog at the Financial Times. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
So have you ever bought Bitcoin? Anyone you know gotten in on the action?
This is Kai from Minneapolis. My grandpa bought 10 Bitcoins back when they were about $770 a piece as a long-term investment, but he had to liquidate them when the price had fallen to $440 a Bitcoin before he passed away from cancer. The last voicemail that I have from him is, "Hey, Kai, give me an update on the old Bitcoins. And I just wish that he could have seen how it turned out.
My name is Adeline, and I'm calling from Chicago, Illinois. I didn't know much about it, didn't really understand it, and I thought I'd be losing $100. Little did I know, I could have been rich.
My name's Aaliyah. I'm calling from Hoboken, New Jersey. My husband and I started mining for Bitcoin back in 2013 when we were still in college, and we ended up with about two. Now we think we have two Bitcoin, but neither of us are willing to sacrifice our computers for long enough to sync to the blockchain and find out. But we plan to hold on to them anyway.
Tell us your Bitcoin stories, 8778MyTake. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. The Canadian Football League has different rules than the NFL. Three downs instead of four, 110 yards, not 100. But the CFL has also taken a different approach to player concussions, cracking down in a way that the NFL has not. Dave Zirin is sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast, and he explains what the CFL is doing.
Well, they're eliminating all contact during practices, and this is a very radical step. The NFL has actually taken a half step towards this, but the Canadian Football League going full in on just practicing tackling on tackling dummies and doing no contact drills, I mean, really is something radical in the context of professional football. And it needs to be pointed out why they're doing this. And this is what a lot of people get wrong about concussions relative to what we know about the science. A lot of laymen, a lot of fans, they think that concussive hits happen with those big hits that you see during the game on Sunday, the kind where the player is just laid out on the field and, you know, even like a stretcher has to come out and people say, oh, the game is so violent. And that's true. But that's not the true violence of the game. The true violence of the game are in what are called subconcussive hits, the small hits, the things you never notice, the linemen bashing into each other at the start of every play. That's where the real damage comes in, and that's where scientists see the link between CTE, the degenerative brain disease, and football.
So what does the science say about what the Canadian Football League is doing here, whether their no hits during practice rule is going to help with concussions? And then the corollary question, of course, is why is the NFL not doing it?
Well, on the first question, I mean, people have to understand that playing tackle football is like a cigarette. And you can make a cigarette with less tar. You can make a cigarette with a larger filter. And it certainly is better for your lungs if you smoke, say, one cigarette a week rather than chain smoking two packs a day. That's all a fact. But it's also a fact that there's no such thing as a danger-free cigarette. There is no such thing as a risk-free cigarette. So while the CFL is turning down the volume on the risk of playing tackle football, the idea that they have made it safe is an absolute pipe dream. Now, the National Football League has not gone this route largely because of complaints from coaches. Now, the great irony of the NFL coaching trees is that you are hard-pressed to find one NFL head coach. There are a couple, but who actually played the game. Most NFL coaches never played in the NFL. Now, when you talk to former NFL players, as I do quite often, they talk about the pain that their fellow retirees go through, whether it's the pain of mental duress, depression, or whether it's just the pain of walking on two degenerative hips and graduating immediately from being a young man to being an old man as soon as your career ends. And so these coaches who, again, never played the sport and tend to be highly, there's no other word for it, militarized in their outlook in terms of how they should see the culture of their team running, they push back very hard on the idea of non-contact drills because that's not the way Vince Lombardi did it and that's not the way Chuck Knoll did it, and therefore that's not the way they want to do it. Unfortunately, their players pay one hell of a price for that.
Well, Dave, what are the players in the Canadian League saying?
From what I'm seeing, it really depends on where the players are in their careers. Because oftentimes, you know, the young players, the players who want to prove themselves to the National Football League, I mean, they want to basically, particularly defensive players, they want to look like they can handle the violence. And there is a concern that if they don't look like they can handle the violence of the NFL, they will never be taken seriously as prospective NFL players. And many players, when they do these polls, it's shocking when you see players, particularly the younger players, say, yeah, like I would gladly take a decade off of my life if it means being able to play in the National Football League, make millions of dollars, and be able to set up my family for life. The older players in the CFL, the ones really who've resigned themselves to this idea that NFL dreams are probably not going to be part of their future, I mean, they appreciate it because they understand that the wear and tear on the body that takes place during the week is far more difficult than even the game conditions themselves.
Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation magazine, host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Dave, great to have you, as always.
Thank you so much, Todd.
We have a story now about climate change on the local level and what happens when a small town confronts the real cost. About 170 coastal communities in the United States are bracing for chronic flooding over the next 20 years. That's according to the Union of Concerned Scientists. That's more than twice the number today. And it's already a reality in the town of Nags Head, North Carolina, in the Outer Banks. Officials and homeowners there are battling with beach erosion and a vanishing shoreline, and also the very real controversy and cost of rising property damage. Nicholas Kuznets recently reported from Nags Head, North Carolina, and wrote about its experiences for Inside Climate News.
These were houses in a little stretch of beach in Nags Head that suffers from really bad erosion, and it had been a problem for a long time. Some of them had been moved back decades earlier. So the town knew that this area was a problem. Then there was a nor'easter that hit in 2009, and it badly damaged the homes, and it caused a fair amount of erosion. And so it meant that these homes were now literally in the surf. And the town wanted to get rid of them. The town wanted to knock them down, said they were a hazard. Their septic tanks were sticking up out of the ground. But several of the owners said, no, you can't do that. You can't take our homes. And they fought back.
So what happened with all the different competing priorities? I imagine the homeowners say, no, you can't take our home. The town said, this is an eyesore and a condemned building has to go. Maybe the county said something else. I don't know. There must be a lot of competing interests here.
Yeah. So basically, the town moved to condemn the homes. Three owners who owned eight of the homes fought back and ended up in court and led to a series of lawsuits that dragged on for years. One of the lawsuits led to a ruling in state court that basically took away the town's ability to condemn homes just because they're out on the beach. Some of the other lawsuits kept going, resulted in settlements of almost $2 million. The town succeeded as part of that huge payout in taking several of the homes off the beach, but a few of them are still there. And the town basically ran out of either the will or the money to keep buying out the homes. The owners now have these homes that, because their septic tanks are exposed, can't be inhabited, but they don't want to let go of, and it's just kind of a stalemate.
I read one of your homeowners in your piece who said, I wish my home would just collapse. Pretty unusual for somebody to wish the whole structure would fall down.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is a man named Lance Goldner. His home's in really bad shape. He doesn't want to fix it up because even if he did fix it up, he wouldn't be able to rent it. The septic tank is sticking out of the ground. He can't get a permit to rebury it. The town has offered him $50,000 for the home, but he says he owes $250,000 on his mortgage, so he doesn't want to, you know, just kiss all of that goodbye. But if a hurricane came and totally obliterated the house, he might be able to collect a good amount of money in insurance.
So, Nick, this would be a pretty interesting story if it were about one small town and a battle between the town and the county and the state and the neighbors over wrecked homes and rising sea levels. But it strikes me this isn't really about Nags Head at all. I mean, they can't be alone here. This seems like there's a cautionary tale that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, that's what drew our interest. I mean, I mentioned that this stretch of beach has particularly bad erosion. So in a sense, it's like a leading edge. It's kind of a vision of what's to come. And that's not to say it'll play out exactly like this. But I think it's fair to say that what happened here was the town didn't have a plan for how it would get rid of these homes when that day of reckoning came, even though it knew it would come one day. So now up and down the country's coasts, we're facing worsening erosion. We know that rising seas will inundate neighborhoods, inundate properties. And yet, if we don't have plans for how we'll protect the coast, where we'll protect the coast, where we'll pull back and when we'll pull back, you know, we can see expensive and messy battles like this coming.
Let's go back to Nags Head for a minute. How big is the area where Mr. Goldner's property got inundated and wrecked and his neighbors too? It seems to me one solution there might be to build something up and protect the beach or protect the homes behind the beach.
So you're talking about coastal protection here, right? I mean, we have billions and billions. I mean, just in Nags Head, it's nearly $1 billion of beachfront property. And so a big strategy across the country is to protect that property. There's various ways to do that. And more coastal engineers and geologists are moving towards what's called known as soft structures, like beach nourishment, which is what Nags Head's doing, basically dredging sand from the ocean floor and pumping it onto beaches. So that's one way of dealing with it. It's expensive. It's temporary. You know, you can build up a beach as they did in New Jersey and New York after Sandy, but it's only going to last a number of years or until the next storm. But it's really the best option in many cases. The other option of building a wall, what you'd get there is you might protect the home behind it, at least for a certain amount of time, but you'd have no beach in front of it. All the sand would be eroded away. Plus, the problem with building walls is they fail. And how high do you build that wall?
It would also seem like the incentives to beach nourishment and all this protection might be a little bit backward, right? Because it sort of cuts against the other thing that you're talking about, which is coming up with long-term proactive plans to get people out of the way.
That's right. I mean, proponents of beach nourishment say that it's well worth the money based on what it's protecting and the tax base it's protecting. Because if Nags Head lost its coastal property, it would lose its tax base and its reason for being. But the concern is exactly what you pointed out, that when you build up these beaches, you can sort of hide the risk that's really there. And North Carolina, for example, has passed some rules that's meant to help towns that have these long-term beach nourishment programs take advantage of that. But the risk is that you're continuing to build in risky areas.
Is anybody in a position of policymaking at the state level, the federal level, taking this type of long-term thinking seriously? Because notoriously, they don't. I mean, as you know, government is generally reactive. You're talking about proactivity with a 20 to 50 year horizon.
I think the short answer is no. There's no federal plan for this. Some states have varying degrees of plans. A lot of the decision making is devolved to local communities like Nags Head. The federal government has spent billions of dollars on beach nourishment, for example, but almost all of that is reactive. It's FEMA money after hurricanes hit. It's not a long-term plan.
Nick Kuznets, reporter with Inside Climate News. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Stories alleging sexual harassment or assault are hitting the news every day, and journalists are left trying to find the most responsible way to cover them. One of the hardest issues can be how to corroborate each story.
So I am the reporter, and I get a tip or hear, or you as a victim of this violence come to me and say, this horrible thing happened to me. My first response, or depending on the succession of the story, eventual response, will be, who did you tell after this happened?
That's Koa Beck there, editor-in-chief of Jezebel. Each week, Koa and New York Times gender editor Jessica Bennett join us to talk about one piece of this Me Too moment. This week, Jessica and Koa look at a gap in how news outlets cover stories of assault and harassment. As Koa Beck explains, for most outlets, corroborating a victim's account starts with asking who they told after the fact.
For a lot of victims in a lot of landscapes and a lot of industries, they will say no one. And this is also assuming that a police report is not accessible, because we already know that the majority of rapes and harassments in this country are not taken to the police and not taken to HR. So we're already going and assuming that you don't have a record of that. Then what happens is, assuming that you did tell someone, that I'm like, great, put me in touch with your mom, your sister, your coworker, your friend, your neighbor, who saw you afterwards, who you confided in, who can speak to the fact that this happened to you in this time bracket in which you said that it happened to you. What troubles me as a reporter and as an editor and as somebody who's always been very aware of the statistics in this landscape is that that formula does not account for many victims. Many victims fall through that exact process, not because they are lying or because it didn't happen, but because if you have experienced violence or harassment on this scale, like Weinstein's victims or any of these others, you do not tell anyone. Sometimes you do, or sometimes a colleague will notice that you seem off or notice that you seem erratic, or if you are lucky enough to be in a position where you can take days off. But again, that assumes so much about the resources of this person who has been violated. And also the assumption being that who can you trust in that scenario? Assuming that you've been violated by somebody who is a superior, what is your incentive to tell a colleague, let alone a manager? Jessica, have you struggled with this in your own line of work? I know that you've reported extensively in this space as well.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot because there's no real guidebook for how to do this type of reporting.
Right.
The way that we've dealt with it at the time so far has been, you know, I reported 2 weeks ago a piece about the playwright Israel Horovitz, who is the father of Ad-Rock of the Beastie Boys. And he was accused by 9 women of a variety of assaults. Some of them were 16 at the time. There was one rape. And I was able to get each of these women to ultimately go on the record. And each of those women had to be corroborated by 2 other sources. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine that makes 9, 18, 27 people that you're talking with at all times. And I felt very lucky in that these women were willing to trust me mm-hmm. and had told people at the time. But I think you make a really important point, which is that not everyone has. And even in some of these situations, you know, it's uncomfortable. You're asking to call people who in some cases they haven't talked to in 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
So the woman who was raped was the high school girlfriend of Adam Horovitz.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was raped by his father. She hasn't talked to him in 30 years. And she had to call him up, and I had to call him up and say, did she tell you this at the time? And she hadn't told him at the time. And so it's tricky. You know, this is complicated. And I think that in general, the media world would benefit from talking more openly about our process
mm-hmm.
because there doesn't seem to be a consistent process. And in so many of these cases, there really isn't a paper trail. I used a lot of journals. All of these women had written in journals at the time. And so I was able to collect a lot of journal entries, which, you know, sure, could somebody fake a journal? But probably they're not going to.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, I thought, was really valuable.
I know that at Jezebel, we have been inundated with more tips than ever. And the meetings that I'm having with certain staff members who are being put on these stories, I'm in these conversations where, you know, I am asking the question, did she tell anyone? And more often than not, she didn't. And so I'm rethinking different ways to corroborate that this happened through mental health history, through depression, through any records you have of seeing a therapist. If there are any colleagues you worked with who can account for any erratic behavior, if you seemed off, if you quit suddenly. But even that is very limited in that we are privileging victims who have access to mental health care and who can receive a depression diagnosis and who did have access to a therapist. So for myself and my staff, it is an ongoing conversation to rethink this.
This keeps me up at night because same. Right now in my inbox, I have probably 1,500 unread emails of Me Too stories and tips. Now, I try to read every single one of those, myself or my partner on my team. And the fact of the matter is we simply can't investigate everyone. So how do you prioritize?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you think about which ones are worthy? And are we even, you know, we are human, we are fallible. Should we even be making that decision? The other thing I've been thinking about a lot is that there's no consistency for a lot of this.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, the story that I wrote had 9 named sources and 2 corroborations for each. Other stories have less. In some cases, people are notified of their allegations beforehand. In other cases, and here we are at WNYC, there are very vague descriptions of what went on, and the people who are accused don't actually know what the accusations are.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a lawyer, but to me that seems pretty unprecedented to mm-hmm. not even know what you are accused of. And so I do think we have to think critically about how do we treat these cases?
One of the pushbacks that I'm getting just across my industry is that age-old, you know, concern for the men who have not done anything wrong. And the thing I consistently say is the amount of anxiety we have for that man being needlessly named is not proportionate to the statistical reality. The statistical reality is that a lot of people are raped and a lot of people are sexually harassed. And in mandating this, however subtly, you know, this corroboration through telling people, we are setting up a loophole for sexual violence and sexual harassment, in that in talking with female friends of mine and other reporters who have been in these situations, both as victims and as reporters, what is the preventative measure there? If you're sexually assaulted or harassed, make sure to tell people immediately after it happens, because journalistically, your rape did not happen. That's a horrific thing. So I think in accounting for that landscape and then considering this news cycle, I think we should have a reckoning within our own industry about how we capture and distill and report these stories. Because if our methods do not substantiate most of the rapes that happen in this country and most of the instances of sexual harassment, then literally what is the point of our jobs? What are we doing?
Jessica Bennett is gender editor for the New York Times and author of Feminist Fight Club. She spoke with Koa Beck, editor-in-chief at Jezebel. You can find much more of their takeaway conversations on our website at thetakeaway.org. And that's all for our show today. And if you ever miss a show, you can always check out the Takeaways podcast. You'll find extended interviews there, and it's a great way to get a ton of stories in 40 minutes. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.